news, but just the same, no matter if I do, you'll find that I'm all for you.
You're on the air.
The human condition.
Buck. Yeah, this is Buck.
Hey, listen, man, this is fantastic. It's fantastic. I finally got to talk to you. You know, I've been trying to call you. Phones keep on going wrong. I've been through a lot, you know, in my life, and it's really great to talk to you.
Variety.
Hey, watch it there.
Look at the size of that thing.
Perhaps a little humor? Or maybe just some peace and quiet. Because it's All Night Sunday with the radio on.
On WBAI in New York City.
I know. I'll sing them all and we'll stay all. I don't ever want to go home. I never.
fly beyond the rainbow. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, don't mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. No, no. Yeah, feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah. From the Kentucky coal mine to the California sun, hey, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather, through everything we've done, yeah, Bobby, baby, kept me from the cold. One day of near Selena Sloan, I let him slip away. He's looking for that home, and I hope he finds it. To be holding Bobby's body next to mine. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, that's all that Bobby left me. But if feeling good was easy, loud when he sang the blues. Hey, feeling good was good enough for me. Mm-hmm. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
nice to hear that again.
Yes, it is.
So, I suppose if people are tuning in late, they won't know what we're doing here. And we're not just playing really fabulous music. Talking with the group that's performing Disquieting Muses at the theater at St. Clement's. The show opens
tomorrow night. 8 o'clock. St. Clement's Theater. 46th Street.
On non-commercial radio, listener-supported WBAI.
I stuck that in real good, huh?
I was stopped by calling it a show.
It's a collage, really.
It's a collage, I guess.
Yeah, combination.
A response to the suicides of women artists.
We're very careful about calling it a response because the show very much has to do with us as much as it has to do with those women. And that's why it is a response, you know. Also, because something as subjective as this, you can have a lot of feelings about, and obviously you must have feelings about, but we didn't want to become theorists, you know, because somehow when you put these kind of vibrant, incredible, alive, exciting women into sort of cold, hard, black and white facts, you know, here are the statistics kind of thing. It's not nice, you know, it's not nice. It's as sort of cold as the dates on their tombstone, you know, which is something that we don't like to think about. I mean, we're very much aware of the fact that they're dead, and sometimes, you know,
we forget.
We forget because we're so much alive and we do the show, and sometimes when I'm briefing the cast before the show, I say, you know, hey, you know, let's do the show tonight for Judy and Diane and Virginia and Sylvia and Marilyn and
Billy. And, Billy.
And we all go, yeah, you know, and we forget. And then when we do the show, when I watch it, for example, I get so linked into the life of it, the life that I see the actresses bringing to it. And like, I saw a friend tonight afterwards, and she said to me, oh, my God, you know, oh, I'm just wiped out. It's just so sad. And
you were beaming.
It doesn't happen to me sometimes. I see the show. Sometimes that hits me, but I get linked into our life because we're doing it to find the alternatives and the possibilities. But like just tonight, when we were listening to Over the Rainbow, was on previously, Chrissy just passed by, and we just held each other because all of a sudden it occurred to us both at the same time that Judy was dead. And this incredible, warm, vibrant, alive woman is dead. You know, she's just dead. I mean, she's a cold, hard fact right now. And that's why this whole sense of the response is very, very, very important to us, the sense of keeping the thing warm and living for now. And not that it'll do anything that's undone, you know, but in the hopes that their death gave us something.
Helped us figure out a few things, yeah. You know.
What specifically in your own lives?
What specifically? Wow. I think we've all just grown so immensely since we initially met Betsy and started working on this project.
How long have you been working on it?
Well, uh-huh. Basically it's what, since October?
October.
So October, November, December.
Beginning of October.
It's 5 months. Really,
it was done first at the NYU School of the Arts, and
as one of the projects for you know, those of us who are in senior year, and now we're branching out and really trying to develop it. Yeah, NYU's really backed us a lot in getting the work and being able to go to St. Clement's.
Yeah, actually, they've been really fabulous.
Yeah. Well, they trained us.
Besides training the actresses, the whole attitude, but the head of the department, Omar Shapley, is a man. And a great man, really.
Great
really
artist,
a great
too.
Man and a great artist. And immediately adored the project. And supported
it
incredibly.
But he hired Betsy in the first place.
Yeah, he hired her. On pure belief. He had never seen any of Betsy's work. And just by her own enthusiasm and her own intense belief in what she was talking about, and our reaction to her and how we really dug the idea, you know, he hired her. And I really, personally, I really thank God that he did, because I have just really grown so much, as I'd said before. I guess it's kind of general, but like specifically, you know, I'd been at NYU like for 3 years and was still kind of like shaky as to really what I wanted to do and where my life was going. And My mother gave me the greatest compliment. After I had my whole period with muses and we had just finished our run of shows, Mom said to me, "Do you know, Chris," she said, "you're smiling now the way you smiled when you were 4 years old." It was like all the tensions and all the
suppressions
and the games that I'd felt were necessary to be Christine were like suddenly broken through, and I was beginning to go back and to rediscover, you know, my own worth and me. And it was just like, has been really exciting to really get a belief in myself and be able to walk through a room and not feel like I'm going through some great crises because there's a pair of eyes on me, which I really used to, you know?
Well, I think it's very important about smiling.
Yeah.
What you said, because I know I've spent a lot of my life
you know?
Smiling at everybody. Now I'm a little more able to show what I feel without feeling obligated to smile at everybody I see.
Oh.
Even if I'm crying, ripping up.
I used to smile at everything. No matter what happened, I was happy, you know? I was always the one that brought joy to everybody. When inside, I was really falling apart. And really was very, very hurt by a lot of things. But I never expressed them, you know? And I write poetry, too. And, like, since I've worked in Muses, my poetry has, like, gone through a totally different change. Like, it's gone to a deeper, more depth. Oh, it's just unbelievable. It just really excites me to have been a part of this whole creation. Because it's been also exciting seeing how each of us is growing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how our friendship and our just intensity of being able to talk to people and really be able to say to people what we feel. Because we all go through life thinking that if we say what we feel, people aren't going to like us.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
exactly.
one of the biggest crutches that women, one of the biggest burdens that women have upon them. Not just women, of course, but being that I am a woman, I have to speak from where I am. And I know that I used to feel that if I told somebody what I felt, they wouldn't like me anymore. They would think that I was stupid or something, you know, whatever the, but now, like, I really don't mind saying how I feel. I really don't. And it's a great pleasure, and I enjoy it. Really do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting too to suddenly discover that things that maybe we had felt were deep, dark secrets, you know, our personal
problems.
Ugly, yes,
yeah.
Our
yeah.
Individual problems.
Problems.
You start discovering that every other female in the group has them, and then you start finding, well, gee, Judy did that too, and Deanne
did
that, and Billy did it.
Wait a second.
And you start branching out into other people, and you discover that there is just a whole, there are things that everybody has that they hide because they think nobody else has them. And it's a shame. We walk around with so many masks on and so many compensations for what we are led to believe are inadequacies. And in fact, those masks and those games are the inadequacies, because if we can get rid of those and deal with who we are within ourselves first, then we have much more to present to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's really kind of exciting, because it really could be a mushrooming kind of thing if you know yourself better and like yourself, for crying
so
out loud.
Important.
Then, you know, you can deal with another person and they will feel more free to explore themselves, you know, in dealing with you.
Really?
And it can spiral.
And it can be really nice.
And that's what Deanne really captured in her work, the whole thing of the mask that people wear and carry.
Yeah.
As you're opening, Deanne Jobeth.
Well, one reason, when I began working on Muses, I was building masks and drawing very strange pictures, which people would be frightened by. And which I didn't look at with fear at all, which I used as a self-expression of what I felt. And it bothered me that something I felt so strongly about, people would look at it and go, "What's wrong with you? You know, are you sick or something?
Are you crazy?"
Yeah, something's definitely wrong with you. And then I looked at Deanne Arbus's work, and I went, "Aha, I'm not alone here."
Yes.
Someone else occupies this space with me. And it was Deanne Arbus. And basically, I really don't know much about her life. I've only seen her pictures, and that's basically where my performance stems from her pictures. She's a very incredible woman. She also dealt with the type of persona through our research. She felt there were two of her also. The woman with the camera who had a license to walk into people's lives and to be aggressive in the outside world, and the other one who was married and had a child. If I may quote her, she says something like, I'm kind of two-faced. I'm very ingratiating. It really kind of annoys me. Now, something like that I identify with so tremendously, because I know for myself that many times when I felt like one of her freaky pictures, I would observe myself walking across the room smiling at somebody and just going, why am I doing this? But I felt a responsibility as my role to do this, to make people happy, to smile, to be submissive, not to be aggressive and
not
say,
to let
I
them
need.
Know how you feel.
And not to cause trouble.
Of course.
Yeah.
But Deanne Arbus got it right out in the open. She put these people who all wanted desperately to be something else and tried so hard to wear it on the outside, even if it looked like a mask. At least it was, they were trying to make a true mask for themselves. You know, a true image of some sort. But unfortunately, an image is an image.
And it doesn't,
and
really
it doesn't work all the
time. A photograph is a photograph.
And
it's only one moment.
A photograph.
You know?
And that's what Deanne did. And it seems that she apparently had the same trouble. I don't know. That's only a guess.
How did she die?
She slit her wrists. In 1971. Mm-hmm. All by herself. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a shame to me, personally, that when I truly express myself many times, it frightens people away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so unnecessary. Just the masks let down the veil.
Yeah. And also, when you've been one type of person to somebody, and then all of a sudden you turn around and are a completely different person, or
or you suddenly show them a part of you you've previously hidden.
What's really it?
When they'll be scared and go away because I can't understand the dialectic.
Of course, the smile drops every once in a while.
Exactly.
And you gotta say, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the matter with you? Why don't you be yourself?
Why smile,
Chris.
Smile.
Exactly.
Be happy. Yeah.
Because it's inconceivable for them to think that you are that person who jumps out for a minute. You really are that person. They don't want to deal with it because it causes more problems than the
Something
one that
they
can
have
cope.
To deal with.
The power of Deanne's pictures is amazing because every time we brought Deanne's book into a rehearsal or even began to talk about Deanne, the cast would begin to freak out. We'd begin to get like these unbelievable tensions would begin to build up and arguments and as Jo Beth would say, you started throwing the book around and we'd have the book of photographs and passing it around violently.
And assertions.
Yes.
Were
like
incredible.
Incredible. Just at the mention or even beginning to look at one of her images would begin to freak each of us out in such ways that it was unbelievable.
Very
the power
powerful
of it. The power
stuff
of her pictures.
Yeah.
I really wish I had seen her show when it was at Modern Art, because that must have been incredible just to see people's reactions. Just
I have been so many of those people in her book. It's incredible. All of them seem some way out of place with themselves and with their environment.
Well, haven't we all?
Of course.
That's it, you know.
That's the strange thing about her pictures, that they seem freaky, you know.
But
she's
then it's
known
us
for taking pictures of freaks. And you try dealing with her photographs, and it somehow the very essence of you is touched in this incredibly frightening way, the way that people are trapped inside their bodies and trapped inside environments and trapped inside relationships, and this fear and pain sort of staring out of the traps and the masks, and it's a kind of feeling of suffocation when you look at the photographs.
Yeah.
And in
yeah
fact, when we interrelate around her book of photographs, we're all fighting suffocation. I mean, there's a tremendous oppression in the air, and we're all sort of trying to fight through it. It's incredible the kind of visceral effect it has every time that we've dealt with that, every time we've taken that fabulous white aperture monograph of photographs and dealt with it in rehearsal. The pall has just settled on the room and we've had to sort of fight through it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's remarkable.
It's
we learn
spurs
a tremendous amount by doing
it. It spurs you to fighting about it. It's
yeah
because the power of it is so total and so
yeah
complete that you don't just go, ugh. But you immediately begin
to react,
bursting out, and that's where
it
her work really gets it on, because it forces you to go, wow, wait a minute, let me out of here.
Wait a second.
And that's that's a very healthy response. Of course, it's frightening because it's such a strong reaction. I mean, you're looking at a picture, for heaven's sakes. You're not supposed to react like that. You're supposed to be able to look at it and go analyze and go,
it's black and white picture.
Right, it's black and white photograph.
It's a self-portrait.
But the lady really had her stuff down.
Yes, yeah, she did.
Yeah, she was just tremendously effective. And it was very hard for us because we did research into articles written about her, and the kind of distancing that the critics would do in order to sort of save themselves from her photographs.
This isn't
from
really
her photographs.
Me that's being affected.
Well, you know, Dionne Arbus is one of the Walt Whitman-esque derivatives, you know. And, you know, and she was kind of photographing the common man in a very disgusting way. You know, just
a garble of words.
Strange kind of thing where obviously somebody was really being hit viscerally and was hiding from it and trying not to deal with it because it does hit so strongly. And in fact, Jo Beth, who does Deanne's faces in the show as a mime artist, is very upsetting to people. Even though she uses her face, but people really find it upsetting. And that's only Deanne, you know, once removed. I mean,
very removed.
A lot of times removed because it's Jo Beth's face.
It's
not a photograph at all.
Remove your face, Jo Beth.
But she was just an incredibly, incredibly powerful, powerful woman, like all these women were.
And also the fact that she took pictures of people who actually showed their masks or
so blatantly
showed they were born that way, whereas other people may feel that way inside, but they're not their exterior is not distorted. Mm-hmm. Their exterior is not contorted.
Mm-hmm. She speaks of freaks as a sort of aristocracy who are born with their traumas, and they don't live their entire lives in fear waiting for that trauma to happen to them, that they can just openly express and say, okay, I've had a trauma, and here I am, and this is me openly and honestly, which is hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, you want to talk about, like, some of the images in case people don't know what kind of pictures Deanne took? Like, you know, fat ladies at circuses.
Yeah, transvestites and burlesque queens.
Twins.
Shiny ladies.
Twins, lots triplets.
Lots of twins.
Yes, lots.
Dwarfs.
Triplets.
And there's that picture of the giant standing above
swords
his parents.
With his parents.
Yeah.
She has a whole series of pictures from a nudist colony, another series of pictures from a home for retarded adults.
Yeah.
Tattooed man, midgets in their living room in New York.
Masks on masks.
People with masks on. Scaffoldings, fronts of houses without anything behind, a landscape of a country on a New York lobby with a wall behind it.
Yes, where you can see the plug. Yeah. There's an incredible picture of the opening at a gallery.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which is just the essence of the trap. It's incredible. You look at this picture and you think you're looking at four posed mannequins or something. And then you realize that there are people sitting there socializing at an opening at an art gallery.
And then no pictures.
With a blank wall behind
wall.
Them.
Right.
Thank you.
You just go, wait a minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible stuff. Yeah. Well, you went to her show at the Modern, right?
Yeah.
How did the people react?
It was very strange. It was very strange. It's really hard to tell. Those kind of things are so difficult, you know, because people have their own masks on, and I always find them very freaky, you know, to go to exhibits where people are going out in public to respond to something. I mean, we responded in private, or what's considerably private, because we're so close. And in that kind of atmosphere, you just see people fighting through the masks in really strange ways because they're in a public place, and so they have to wear their mask, and then they're fighting through the mask as they look at Deanne's mask.
Fighting to hold the mask on so nobody sees how their reaction, you know, is working so strongly. And this whole thing is, you know, like an inch in front of their face going on. It's very difficult.
It's very, very difficult. There's
to
just
judge,
an
exactly.
incredible amount of tension. One time when we were doing the show at NYU, I went to a photography show on suicide that was being done on the East Side because I thought it would, you know, I would get some images to tell the girls about. And it was definitely one of the freakiest all-time experiences. I came back shaking into rehearsal because there they all were, you know, the East Side crowd, sort of standing around talking about suicide like a Dionne Arbus photograph.
you know, drinking their champagne and talking.
The girl walking around saying,
This girl walking around saying,
I'm committed to this.
That's me in the photographs, you know, yes. And
I tried to slip my wrist.
It's a whole kind of voyeurism. And Diane Arbus, has, in one of the critical articles about her, was accused of being a voyeur, which I think is just extremely unfair. Because she wasn't in any way. I mean, she experienced...
I think so, too.
...fully the photographs that she took. There's just no doubt about it.
I agree.
The whole idea of them being self-portraits. Some of the pictures she took were of just people like, so we'd call ordinary people, walking down the street. But what she captured in each person... For example, there's one of a young man and a young woman who are the dance contest winners.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm sure they're two charming children. But this picture is bizarre. It makes them look almost like they're the husband and wife on top of a wedding cake. Mm-hmm. It really does. They look just frozen in plastic. And only Diane Arbus could take a picture like that. Mm-hmm. Only because it is a self-portrait. Mm-hmm. That makes it her art.
Mm. And she really feels that it is a self-portrait. You know, she doesn't... She recognizes that part of herself, I think.
Well, she always talks about herself as being behind the glass rather than the subjects of her photographs as being behind the glass. And she always says how she's protected by the glass. Even if a war were to go on and someone were to hold a shotgun at her, as long as she were behind her, the glass of her camera, she would be protected. And unfortunately, that's the whole sense that all these women had. Virginia Woolf, in A Room of One's Own, when she's crossing the common, talks about how she feels that her body was distilled behind a glass. And of course, Sylvia Plath with the bell jar. And this whole sense, of course, of being disembodied, which is just another whole aspect that we found in these women that leads us into Marilyn, another aspect of their fragmentation was complete disembodiment. Their body was one thing and their self was another. And the body sort of went around encased in glass or encased in clothes or trapped, encased in different kind of images and physiques and so on, and sort of did things for people. But then the self, of course, kind of sometimes lived inside the body and sometimes didn't. And of course, the thing that's so frightening about this whole aspect of disembodiment is that it's completely accepted and rewarded in every way by society.
Oh, well, you can't survive without doing it. We all do it to a certain extent, to varying degrees. You have to make that adaptation to survive in the society.
Sure, but I mean,
adaptation.
You get an exaggerated case of schizophrenic disembodiment like Marilyn Monroe, and she becomes the highest paid movie actress in Hollywood when what she should have, you know, what anyone should have done for her was, of course, given her help, because, I mean, here was a lovely, sensitive actress from what we know about her, from the books we've read about her and so on and so on. Who was just caught in a wicked way in this kind of disembodiment, you know, just was absolutely no part of her. I mean, in the sense that people said that, you know, when you met her, she was unsexy in the extreme. I mean, people have met her in person and said she was the unsexiest woman you could ever meet because she was totally out of her body. I mean, the body would stand there, but the self wasn't there, and she was so unaware of her sex and unaware of herself. And this is, of course, also brought out in the fact that when she wasn't on camera and when she didn't go out, she was a mess. I mean, she didn't brush her teeth, she didn't comb her hair, she didn't wash, she didn't change her clothes for days. It was only when she had to present the image that she would get herself up. And then when she got herself up, it wasn't even human.
She had to do it perfectly.
It was horrible. She put on body makeup from tip to toe for hours. I mean, covering her body with junk and clothes and crinolines and tulle and all kinds. I mean, just incredible objectification of your own body, just making it a complete object. I mean, she did it to herself. Of course, was rewarded by it.
Oh, heavens, yes.
A million percent.
Right. Yeah.
Everyone loved her for it.
Right.
That,
but nobody loved herself.
That was the trap.
Everybody loved her body.
She was loved for herself. As my mom said, she said that when she was a young girl, Marilyn was who you wanted to be and who you wanted to look like. And they would all comb their hair like Marilyn and try to walk like her and talk like her. You know, that really blew my mind when I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think of what a crisis it was for her, Marilyn, and nobody realized it. Nobody ever stopped to sit down and really talk with her and be with her, you know. Well, she was the prime case of somebody who didn't have their parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, she really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And with the studying that we've been doing, we really feel that really had to do with why Marilyn really developed Marilyn. Norma Jean developed this Marilyn as a pure survival tactic, mm-hmm. to try to get some sense of self, because she had no parents to help to gel any kind of self-image or self-belief, you know.
Yeah, you know? It was totally constructed. And her whole early life had been a complete series of rejections and her mother being
foster
away
homes
and foster and homes and being handed around like, you know, a box of candy.
And the first time she really received any personal attention, any interest in her,
was when she went through puberty and started developing her figure. And all of a sudden she got positive reinforcement. And so, of course, you know, something goes click. Oh, you know, I can get it this way. They like me because I look pretty. You know, exactly. And it just got totally exploited because no other side got developed, because she went so completely with that and it was so thoroughly rewarded that everything else got neglected.
That she just sang. She just kept in that one image and was mm-hmm. trapped.
Exactly, really? And any time that she did try to go for any self-fulfillment or ego-building, she always had to have people constantly around her to reassure her that she was doing something that was for her.
Yeah.
Because I really feel that she felt guilty if she was ever doing anything for herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she had to. She tried to be an actress. She tried to be a stage actress, but she couldn't handle it.
Well, she received a lot of censure from Hollywood when she took off from her Hollywood contract and came to New York and did the whole actor's studio training thing. She just, you know, Hollywood was not happy. Here's their number one box office draw, running off to study to be an actress. What do you want to do that for? You're making millions, baby.
She was greatly slandered for that also. Yeah. People constantly said that she's not an actress, she's just a body, she'll never be an actress, she's just dull and dim-witted. And
of course she also constructed her own bell jar, because when she did a part like in The Asphalt Jungle, where she won an award for being the most promising young actress in Hollywood, and she did do some lovely acting in that film, dying to be accepted as an actress, dying to be accepted as a serious artist and a serious woman,
dying
she
to
wears
be accepted.
A low-cut, see-through, no-back dress to the winning of the award. Of course, all attention is onto her body. Zap the actress, zap the serious artist, zap the serious woman. Everybody's talking about her as a sex symbol, and she's in a depression for months because, oh, wow,
all they
I'm
talked
only
about
body.
Was her dress.
But she couldn't do away with that. She couldn't go and say, yeah, good for me. I did that work, and I can accept that award, and I deserve it. That was just too much. She couldn't go
her
without
her
protection.
She couldn't, right, she could not let go that survival that had brought her through life. That is what made her survive in the world, and if she let that down and let it go,
it would mean death.
They might have gotten her.
It would mean
her,
death. You know? They might have gotten her.
How is she
definitely
supposed to know?
Yeah.
And I think that she also looked for salvation, so to speak, in her husbands.
Sure. Oh,
yeah. I mean, Joe DiMaggio and Arthur Miller. I mean, she totally went into that relationship wanting to be the ideal for that man. But see, she couldn't do that either, because she had to be the famous Marilyn Monroe, who had millions of people loving her. She wasn't content with being just somebody's wife who learned how to make
Norma Jean.
Norma Jean. She couldn't be Norma Jean because it wasn't enough for her. She couldn't assert herself.
Or she thought it wasn't enough because she'd never allowed Norma Jean to develop.
To exist.
Or people had never given her a chance to develop Norma Jean. Marilyn had developed. Marilyn was making it. So Norma Jean should just stay in the corner, you know?
Yeah.
And any time Norma Jean came out, Marilyn would rip around the corner and say, wait a second, hey, let's get it back together. You're a movie star and people love you, you know.
The thing that's so frightening about Monroe is that it's absolutely the grossest self-effacement that could, you know, possibly happen. I mean, the sense of this woman putting herself, I mean, intelligent woman, you know, who wrote poetry. I mean, we have some of the poetry she wrote, and it's not great poetry, but it's sensitive, and who loved reading, you know, who wanted to meet Carl Sandburg, who loved reading Rilke, and you know, and was dreaming of doing Dostoevsky one day. I mean, these were goals of
and
hers.
And people laughed
which meant
at
something
her
about
on
her.
The set. when sure. she told them about it. Sure. The press made fun of her, everyone laughed sure. at her.
But the fact that this woman who had this kind of sensitivity should play parts, you know, like the 7-year itch, and should perform constantly that persona of the idiot. I mean, the imbecile child mm-hmm. who could only, you know, flutter and flitter
and function for you
and fulfill everybody else's needs and never speak coherently and like taking cold baths in the winter and hot baths in the summer and potato chips are so good but they get your fingers greasy. I mean, this total imbecile child. I mean, the kind of self-effacement that must go on, you know, and the kind of fragmentation that must go on in your head to just, you know, to perform that persona of being constantly put down for being stupid. Constantly being put down for being a dumb blonde. It's just
And the
horrible.
Only way that she could make anyone feel those needs, really say to them, I'm going to get you back for calling me an idiot, was being 7 hours late on a set, was not showing up for rehearsal, was getting sick all the time. And she knew that she could do it because she had built up this image that everybody loved. She knew that
they couldn't
everybody
make a movie without
loved
her,
and they couldn't make a movie without her. And she nailed them to the wall and made them realize it every single day she was on a movie.
Yeah.
But she never came out and said it.
Right.
No,
if she would have been fantastic.
Sit in a bathtub.
If she had ever accepted an assertive role,
then she might have
done something with her. She might have got through it.
She really might have. And it would have been very important.
I mean,
women, if she'd done that.
Let me just read some quotes that I believe this comes out of Ms. Magazine. And just her ideas about things. It just shows that she was terribly confused between what she really felt that she should assert herself and the role that she felt was demanded on her. She says, love is a relationship. A woman needs to... Well, to support a man, emotionally, I mean. And a man needs to be strong. This is partly what it means to be masculine or feminine. I think it's terribly important to feel feminine, to act feminine. Men need women to be feminine. You know, never, I need. Then she says, being 36 years old is just great, as long as kids and men still whistle. There has to be some change with time. I wonder why they don't put more stress on casting older parts, not just spring lovers. I want to become a marvelous character actress like Maria Dresler. I mean, that's a complete contradiction right in that statement about being 36 years old is great as long as kids and men still whistle at you, and then she wants to be a character actress.
Right.
I mean, that's really a complete split right there.
Yeah.
And then she says, I need lots of new things, and when I get them, I'm going to begin having some small dinner parties, some candlelight dinner parties. I want a crystal chandelier with real candles in it over the mirrored table. I want big, comfortable club chairs, not delicate, spindly little things, but big. You know why? For a man to sit in. I mean, this real need to have a home and have someone protect her, because that's what she was really seeking through all her life. And she never found that it was herself that was the protector, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the horrific thing
she
that Peggy just said.
She never quite had the strength to let herself do it for herself, you know,
right.
And take the chance that you can do it. You have all those parts of you. Everybody does. But unfortunately, they get really locked away from an early age for most of us.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral little scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rise, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
In the morning, do your shopping, baby. Oh, I love my love thing, super right inside my love thing. You may disappear, but you'll be back, I swear. Would you love to love me, baby? Oh, I'd love to love you, baby. In the morning, do your shopping, baby. Oh, I love my love things, super right inside my love things. You may leave the fair, but you'll be back, I swear. Would you love to love me, baby? I would love to love you, baby.
We're back with All Night Sunday with Radio On, Disquieting Muses, a response to the suicides of women artists. One thing that we've talked around and about, but not really dealt with, is the suicide aspect of this whole thing. And in a little while, I'd like to open this up for telephone calls from people who are listening who have something to contribute or ask or just want to talk to somebody. The number, if you want to call, is 371-5200. And I'll repeat that because we don't repeat it enough, I'm told. 371-5200. Don't call the other number that you know about. Only that number. So, this is Suzanne Schoen, I should say, hourly. So people shouldn't forget I'm here. The suicide aspect is really one that fascinates me in a frightening way, and I suppose that's true of most people. And I wondered how that touched your own lives, and if you had had any real contemplation of suicide or near suicides or something.
Well, it would be near, wouldn't it?
I mean, near in the sense of actually attempting it and obviously not succeeding.
I think basically the way we dealt with the women's suicides in this piece is that because of the lack of options, because of the few alternatives that they did have in their lives, it was the only logical alternative to come to them, you know, they thought. And, you see, the more, I don't think I've ever contemplated seriously suicide. And, I think the more, the reason is, and the reason this is such a hopeful project is because we are expanding our lives. We are giving ourselves, a myriad of options. And, when you do, when you have more options, you choose to learn more about yourself and therefore go in a different direction, suicide no longer becomes an alternative, you know.
Because you discover daily that there are more and more options available to you. As soon as you begin taking the steps to expand your options, you start getting away from the trap of feeling like you've run out of options, because if you try a new one every once in a while, and hopefully don't meet with total rejection, it gives you the courage to expand more and more, and you can avoid getting to the point where your only option is to end the struggle. Which is, I mean, my feeling now about the suicide is that it's actually a hopeful, positive move. I mean, obviously, they died because of it, but it ended a struggle which had been becoming unbearable, evidently.
Well, that was wonderful.
That was lovely. What was that?
Oh, I see. We're taking telephone calls now. Thank you.
That's what it is.
BAI, you're on the air.
Yeah. About Monroe, there's one thing I think that you left out, and that is the last film that she did, The Misfits, I think was an attempt, you know, on her part to take on a role other than, you know, a feather-headed, I mean, I think in the film she explored the sensitivity and the sensitivity towards human life, you know, towards animal life at any rate, you know. Interestingly, that film, that was the only film that she ever did, it was Pan. And she did a beautiful acting job in that, I thought.
Well, I would agree with you about the acting job, but I wouldn't agree with you that was really any kind of attempt of Marilyn Monroe's to express herself. For one thing, of course, the film was written as a screenplay by her husband, Arthur Miller, and it was based on a short story of his, which was based on a real-life incident. I don't know if you know, supposedly, where they were walking along the beach at Amagansett, where they had their summer house, and she saw a bunch of fish who were dying. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, was terribly scared of death because she herself was dying every day. And she said, oh, I can't watch this, they're dying. Yes, I'm watching it, I can watch it. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, we talked a lot about this, about our women, and particularly Monroe, for example, we're talking about her, how she displaced her own needs onto helpless animals, for example. Mm-hmm. And the most excited she ever got about anything she wanted for herself was in untying the horses in The Misfits, in untying the Mustangs.
but I suppose you could call it a step forward. That finally in a film, a tied up Mustang is an image for a trapped woman.
You know, like pants and a shirt.
What?
She wore pants and a shirt.
Oh, yeah, she did wear pants and a shirt. That's
and
quite true.
And there was never any other film where I'd ever seen her in anything but a dress.
Yeah. But she also had numerous fights with Miller on the script.
Oh,
because
I'm sure.
She realized what he was doing. He was exposing every nerve in her her being.
Right.
And she...
She became
had,
his object, you
yes,
see. She became
she
his
had,
matter for artistic creation instead of becoming her own.
And she wanted... some of those scenes cut right out of the film,
mm-hmm.
and she went through a real trauma doing the film, and I'm sure it wasn't her choice to do that. She was forced into it, and I'm sure, I believe personally that it did lead to her eventual suicide.
Because Miller, you see, was such a tremendous influence on her, and when he didn't work, when he objectified her, when he, the hope of her whole life, also objectified her, she couldn't survive it. She just couldn't survive that loss, and it is what did her in, although he, of course, wasn't personally responsible. The sense of that last choice is what did her in. I agree with you about wearing the pants and the shirt, and we mentioned one time in rehearsal, we were discussing her love scenes, how in all the love scenes, she was such a completely self-effacing, I don't want anything from you, kiss me doll.
Mm-hmm.
In the one kiss she had with Clark Gable in that scene, it was the first time she ever responded to a kiss on screen in a human, womanly way. Which was a huge step forward, but when you consider we're talking about the sex symbol of America,
yeah.
It's a very frightening thought.
Well, I'm saying, I guess what I'm saying is that I think...
Oh, whoops.
Ooh, that is terrible.
Her?
I think we did.
What?
Oh, no. We're still there. Oh, good.
Could you repeat what you just said? I'm sorry, we missed it.
Yeah, I didn't finish it because I heard this comment.
Heard it too.
That I think that film was was for her an important step, just like a baby step, you know.
Yes,
that's true. That's very true.
And that in many respects, the media and the public, you know, like spanked her.
Yes.
For it, and I think that you know by the.
Oh,
dear. Oh. Jesus. That is such a terrible sound.
Tell her to hold on a minute. I'm
going to
put the call control in here.
Okay.
Hang on a sec.
Please hold on.
We're right there.
Press the button on your phone.
I think that was what was really so disastrous for her. Was that you know, public spanking almost.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Towards her.
Yes, well, she actually... made that first effort to come out a little bit and was immediately rejected for
right.
it.
That's
you know?
What I mean. Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right, which is one of the reasons why she could never give up that image of the beautiful, perfect body doll, because they didn't want to see any else.
And look what she was doing when she did die.
Sure, something's got to give, but the real representation of her rebellion against that film was that nude swim scene
right.
where she literally tore her bathing suit off and just flung herself, and she said, all right, you want me, you got me, this is me, all over the place.
Yeah.
But she wanted the pictures printed. She did want them printed. Mm-hmm. And then I think she backed out on a cover of Playboy that she was supposed to be on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think she was really saying there, all right, this is what you want, and you're going to get it, and this, everyone wants this, and this is what I'm going to give you.
This is what I'm going to give you. I'm obliged to say this is WBAI FM in New York City.
Just started talking about suicide, and I just finished the Phyllis Chesler book, Women in Madness.
Yeah.
And in it, I was quite shocked to find, you know, in terms of statistics, that in actuality, more men commit suicide, in other words, go all the way through with it, I mean, die as a result than women, but that more women attempt suicide.
I think the reason for that may be, we discussed it in a rehearsal one time, that... men, the methods that men use are always very straightforward, direct, kill me.
A rifle
to your head.
Things that just can't miss.
Yes, things that can't miss. Whereas women go for very
painful, very lingering.
Yeah. Well, yes. Poison and things that, you know, you can be saved before the actual completion might go on.
Right.
Which and I turned on in the middle of the program, so I don't know, you talk about rehearsals. What is the group?
Oh.
Sorry.
Disquieting Muses.
Quieting Muses.
I'm glad you asked.
What kind of material? I mean, do you do plays or new plays or?
That's the name of our play. It's a theater collage, actually, called Disquieting Muses, which is a response to the suicide of women artists.
Well, listen.
We're doing it this week at St. Clement's.
I'd love to get in touch with you because I'm writing, and I've written a one-act play
about
a woman, one character, one-act play. Mm-hmm. A woman that commits suicide by turning on the gas.
Oh, wow.
Sylvia lives.
Okay.
Well, come see the show and come and speak with Betsy and with all of us.
You're right.
It's at St. Clement's, and it'll be on this whole
Clements?
Week.
St. Clements. It's 423 West 46th Street. Fine.
I could just ask for who?
Betsy Chevy.
Yeah.
She's the director. And come and speak with any of the actresses.
Right. We love all-